One of Hollywood's biggest stars of the 1950s and 60s also had one of the most distinctive voices in film. My guest Kirk Douglas starred in the movies Champion, 7 Days in May, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Lust for Life, Paths of Glory, Spartacus, Gunfight at the OK Corral, and Tough Guys. Douglas is the son of poor, illiterate Russian-Jewish immigrants. He writes about his life on and off the screen in his autobiography, The Ragman's Son, which is just out in paperback. In his book, Douglas talks about how he formed his own production company. He was one of the first actors in Hollywood to strike out on his own. His son, Michael, has followed in his father's footsteps as an actor and producer. I asked Kirk Douglas why he started producing his own films.
I wanted a production company so that I could find something that I wanted to do and then try to develop it. And sometimes I was very successful at doing that. Spartacus, Paths of Glory, but sometimes I was very unsuccessful, as when I bought One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and had it for 10 years and shopped it all over town and nobody wanted to do it until my son Michael said, look, Dad, let's be partners. Let me see if I can get the money. And he went outside of the industry and got the money and the rest is history.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the film Spartacus, in which you both starred and produced. You ended up casting Gene Simmons in the role of Spartacus's lover and the woman who he has a baby with. And initially you didn't want to cast her because she's British and you thought that that would ruin the linguistic pattern of the movie. And I'd love for you to explain what you meant by that.
Well, I have a very simple... For example, when I did the Vikings, all the Vikings are Americans. We have a rougher pattern of speech. The English have a more elegant pattern of speech. So that makes it work. In Spartacus, you'll notice that all the aristocratic Romans are English.
That's right. They're great, great stage actors, great British stage actors.
The slaves, like myself, were Americans.
Not only that, ethnic, right? Jewish, Italian.
You see, it's just that Americans have a rougher speech pattern. For example, I often think that Shakespeare very often is better played in one is done in the United States, because those beautiful lines take on a rougher quality that I think Shakespeare really intended it.
So the slaves have the rough quality, and the Romans have the more genteel, educated, refined sound.
Exactly. Of course.
Was this intentional? Is this standard, or is this just something you wanted to do? Do you think it's pretty standard in epics of that period to cast that way?
I don't know. I never thought of it that way. It was just, my way of looking at the picture. And of course, Spartacus, you picked on a picture that is a big section in my book, because so much happened during the making of Spartacus. The most historical event was the breaking of the blacklist. And that's one of the reasons that Spartacus is so important to me.
Well, that's right. Well, Dalton Trumbo was writing it under a pseudonym, like he was writing all of his screenplays at the time, because he was blacklisted. And you insisted that for this movie he actually use his real name. Did you think that the time was right where you could say, this is Dalton Trumbo who wrote the movie, and where it would actually be accepted, that the time was right to break the blacklisting and have it be accepted, at least in part of Hollywood?
Well, I'm not so sure. I did it rather impulsively. I don't think I was aware until a couple years later, as I reflected upon it, and as I explain in my book, I began to see the significance of it. What bothered me when I did Spartacus was the hypocrisy in Hollywood, that these people, some of them who spent a year in jail for a crime that was never very clearly stated, were denied denied using their talents except behind the scenes. Studio heads would look the other way while a lot of these unfriendly 10 writers would be writing scripts for very little money. So it was so hypocritical that it annoyed me to the extent that I said, well, what happens? We had a discussion of whose name are we going to put on the screen of Spartacus. And suddenly I said, well, what happens if I put Dalton Trumbo's name on? And they said, oh, Kirk, you're bound. They said, you're going to get out of the business and all that. I said, no, the hell with it. I'm going to do it. And the next day I left the pass. Dalton Trumbo hadn't been on a set in 10 years. I left the pass for Dalton Trumbo. No Sam Jackson. Of course, even Sam Jackson, we wouldn't have allowed on the set, somebody might have recognized him as Dalton Trumbo.
That was his pen name for this movie.
Yes, and from then on, I mean, I'll never forget when Dalton Trumbo walked on the set, came over to me and says, Kirk, thanks for giving me back my name. There were people who, I got letters from different organizations, had a hopper attack me, but the sky didn't fall in. And after that, a few months after that, Otto Preminger announced that Dalton Trumbo was going to be writing this script, and the blacklist was broken.
Since we're talking about Spartacus, let me play a clip from the movie. And this is toward the end of the first half of the film. Remember, this movie had an intermission. And Spartacus and many other slaves have escaped from slavery. And after they've escaped, many of the slaves are just drinking wine. They're having Romans fight each other as if the Romans were slaves. And Spartacus is saying, what are you doing with your lives? You should be doing something more productive. And he suggests that they actually fight the Roman Empire.
What are we, Crixus? What are we becoming, Romans? We look for wine when we should be hunting bread.
When you've got wine, you don't need bread.
Can't just be a gang of drunken raiders.
What else can we be?
Gladiators. An army of gladiators.
Well, they get their army, and you, as Spartacus, lead them against the Roman army. You know the scene where the slave army gets started by burning logs in front of the army, and then they roll the logs down the hill. So these flaming logs force the Roman army to retreat. And you see in the movie a lot of Roman soldiers getting burned by these logs. How'd you do that?
Well, listen, those are the scenes. We don't discuss how we do. You don't have a magician telling you how you do a trick. That was a very effective device that we had a very talented director, Stanley Kubrick, who was doing it. But that in itself is not a very difficult thing to shoot, to have burning logs rolling into soldiers, but it was very effective.
There is a scene at the end that is a mass crucifixion, and you're one of the many actors on the cross at the end of the movie. And I'd really like to know how you were attached to the cross so that you could hang there without really hurting yourself.
Well, as a matter of fact, playing that scene, we learned an awful lot about crucifixion. We learned that it would be impossible to be crucified the way very often you see a crucifixion. You know, the body would sag right down. But to make our scenes effective, it was very easy. Every cross had a bicycle seat that just kept the body up high enough so that you wouldn't be sagging down in a very unattractive position.
Okay, so that's the secret. You quote your wife in your book, who once said to you, it's an unnatural life just being wrapped up in make-believe characters. You've played so many different characters through the course of your career. Were you ever confused about who you really were as opposed to who the characters you played were?
Well, the only time I encountered something similar to that was in playing Lust for Life. Van Gogh really was a painful character to play. And it was so easy to study his character because there's a whole book of letters that he wrote to his brother. And reading those letters, you could understand him so perfectly. And shooting the picture, we shot it in Auvers-sur-Oise and Arles, Les Baux, all the places that Van Gogh lived. And when I came to the town of Auvers-sur-Oise, where Van Gogh died, and I had this stubby red beard and kinky red hair in the outfit, a lot of the old-timers, they actually felt as if Van Gogh had come back. So there was an amazing resemblance that I must have had to Van Gogh, and that all affected me. And the poignancy of that role did really get to me, and it destroyed my original concepts of what acting is all about, where you're supposed to have the discipline of knowing that this is make-believe. And I never watched Lust for Life until about 6 months after it was finished. I just didn't want to even be close to it. It was a painful experience.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you something about you physically in terms of your acting. People think of you, they think of your voice. Physically, they really think of the dimple in your chin. And when you started acting, was there ever a time where that was seen as a disadvantage? Did anyone ever try to cover that up with makeup?
Oh, yeah. The first time I came to Hollywood, you know, and they're looking at this Broadway actor, there was talk of... And they did. They filled it up with putty.
Really?
It had to be an awful lot of putty because I don't have a dimple in my chin. I have a hole in my chin. And it annoyed me. I said, look, I just pushed the putty out. I said, look, this is what you get if you want it. I'm not going to change it. So let me know if this is what you want or I'm going back to New York. And that was the end. I mean, and since then, I've never, you know, it's a part of me.